It's not a matter of if you're going to have an incident, but when. Remember, no one in this room approach to life is saying they will never get sick. Every one of us in this room recognizes we will get sick, and we all know saying we will never get sick is naive. We know we're going to get sick. It's limiting the frequency and the impact. Every organization in here needs to know you are going to have an incident. Saying you will never, ever have an incident is as naive as saying you will never get sick. It's going to happen, and therefore our focus needs to be on timely detection and reaction, which is what incident response is all about. So we're going to lay out our six-step process for incident handling, which is preparation, identification, containment, eradication, recovery, and lessons learned. Then we're going to finish up with a tabletop exercise that we're going to work on together. So you don't actually need your laptops today, but to make sure you're prepared and ready for an incident, you need to go through scenario planning. Incident handling is not intuitive skills. They require practice, and they require a lot of planning to do so. So we're going to talk about the idea of doing planning exercises in your environment to make sure everyone knows how to handle an incident. And I'm going to take you through one of those planning exercises. The way we do these planning exercises is you set up a scenario, and then you go through and do a series of what we call injects. So for example, you would go in and we would say, okay, here's the current scenario. You just had an unusual activity on your IDS. So then we'll discuss, how would you handle it? Then an inject would be, you just get a call from another business unit and five systems are no longer working. Great. What do we do then? Then the next inject would be, our firewall just crashed and stopped working. What would you do then? So it's all about proper planning to make sure that you are ready for anything that might happen. And we do this in all areas of life. One of the things that I do to try to stay healthy is I do compete in triathlons. And when you get ready for a big race and I do my planning, literally I work with my coach and we do a series of injects. So he will say, okay, you're getting ready for race day and you start the race. And he goes, what happens if during the swim you get kicked in the face and you start bleeding? Great. You have an inject for that of how handling it. What if you get out of the water and your wetsuit zipper breaks? How do you get out of the wetsuit? Inject for that. What if you're riding the bike and the tire blows out? Inject for that. Well, what if you go to get on the bike and it starts raining? You have an inject, and literally he's taking me through every possible worst thing that can happen, and I'm doing it on the system. So this way, if it happens during race day, I'm prepared and ready to go. And it's sort of funny because if you do the injects correctly, your training exercises are high stress and the real incident is lower stress. Because if my coach trains me correctly, there's never a race where everything goes wrong. There's never a race that's perfect, but there's never a race that everything goes wrong. So if he has me mentally prepared for every possible thing that could go wrong, and then when I do the race, things go right, I'm actually, wow, that wasn't as bad as I thought. And you're prepared, and preparation is the name of the game. So that's the whole idea of going through this exercise, is just getting you to understand the process so when you go back to work, you know how to implement it. The goal of this lab is not for you to work on an incident. The goal of the lab is to train you on the proper way to get your staff mentally prepared. So when you leave this class, you now have the skills of setting up the tabletop exercise and going through the injects. So we're teaching you how to do the process with an example, but the goal of it is for you to learn the process, not for you to learn one single way to handle an incident. It's to know the process so you can adapt it to your respective environment. And then we do finish up with a bunch of different resources that you can use after class to continue to increase your knowledge of control systems. So let's go ahead and start with our first section on information assurance foundations, where we're going to look at risk. We're going to look at AAA, which is authentication, authorization, and accountability. We're going to look at data classification, vulnerability management, and defense in depth within the enterprise. Now, what I like about doing this on day five is I've talked about all of this all week. I've talked about prevention is ideal and detection is a must, which is defense in depth. I've talked about risk, 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 that before you do anything, you have to ask yourself, what is the risk? Is it the highest priority risk? And is it the most cost-effective way of reducing the risk? Now that you understand the importance of all this, we're going to lay the structure out for how you actually implement it within your environment. When we talk about security, everything we do in security is about understanding, managing, and mitigating risk to our organization. Now, that's great that I throw out risk, and that's even great that I tell you risk is the probability for loss. But let's break this down a little more, because I really want you to understand the key components of it. So when we say risk is the probability for loss, risk at the most basic level is composed of two things. Threat, which is the potential for harm. Anything that could cause harm in your environment is a threat. A foreign adversary trying to break in to your control systems is a threat. A worm trying to propagate in your network is a threat. An employee bringing a USB drive into your control systems is a threat. So threats are the potential for harm. Vulnerabilities are weaknesses that allow those threats to manifest themselves. An unpatched system is a vulnerability. A cryptographic implementation that's not protecting the key is a vulnerability. A control system that's visible from the internet is a vulnerability. So vulnerabilities are weaknesses that allow those threats to manifest themselves. Tying back to Sun Tzu and the art of war, what we're really talking about is a threat is what is the offense capable of? Know thy enemy. Know thy enemy is know thy threats. Then know thyself is the vulnerabilities. So when we talk about Sun Tzu and information warfare, the threat is the enemy or the offense, and the vulnerability is yourself or the defense. Now, at most points, people understand this part. Here's where we sometimes have trouble. If risk is a probability for loss, and we have a high-risk item, that means there's a threat and there's a vulnerability. Now, if there's a threat and a vulnerability that leads to a high risk, if I want to reduce the risk, do I have to reduce both numbers? No, because they're multiplied, I only have to reduce one of these. And if I reduce one, then the risk will be reduced. Which of those two do I control? Vulnerabilities. You don't control threats. You don't control foreign adversaries. You don't control worms. You don't control hurricanes. You don't control natural disasters. The threats are what they are. You only control the vulnerability. Therefore, what's the natural inclination? We should be going in and reducing vulnerabilities, which ultimately will reduce the risk. Great. So we've heard companies, and you've probably heard these terms. Let's fix the low-hanging fruit. Let's just fix the easy stuff first. Let's just go in and fix vulnerabilities so we can show that we're making forward progress. That is a recipe for disaster. And here's why. There's always going to be vulnerabilities. You will never, ever be vulnerability free. Therefore, I don't want you to fix 500 vulnerabilities where there's no threat. I want you to fix 5 vulnerabilities in which there's a real threat. I would rather you fix less vulnerabilities in which there's a real threat than random benign vulnerabilities where there's no threat. So therefore, the mistake that's made is companies want to jump right in and fix vulnerability, vulnerability, vulnerability. The better method is always let threat drive the risk calculation and then let vulnerability drive the risk reduction. And this aligns with that piece of paper that I told you to set up. Remember I said three columns. What was the first column? Your critical assets. So everything you do is about understanding, managing, mitigating risk to your critical assets. Then, once you know your critical assets, you then have to figure out the threats. And once you figure out the threats, you identify the vulnerabilities that would allow those threats to manifest themselves. So these columns were not just randomly picked. They were purposely done in a specific order based on the steps that you would perform. What are the critical assets? What are the threats and what are the vulnerabilities that would allow those threats to manifest themselves? Now, the secret sauce to success here, the secret ingredients that's going to make this all work, is you want to focus in on the threats that have the high likelihood and the vulnerabilities that have the big impact. So if we go back once again to the chart I had you produce, you have your critical assets, but then the second column is what are the threats that have the highest likelihood and what are the vulnerabilities that have the biggest impact. We're focused on the frequency and the consequences to our environment because once again, we are never going to be risk-free. If risks were finite and you could fix them all, then yes, do them in whatever order you want and you'll slowly get them done. But because risks are infinite and you'll never ever be risk-free, we only want to focus in on the frequency and consequences, which are the high likelihood, high impact risks within our environment. The question is, because going after the low-hanging fruit is quicker, easier, and cheaper to do versus doing a detailed assessment of all likelihood and impact. And there could be merit to that. The question I have to you is, what is the goal that you're trying to achieve? If your goal is just to go in and try to show that you're doing some basic things in the environment, then going in and doing the low-hanging fruit might work. My problem with going after the low-hanging fruit is this. You're most likely fixing vulnerabilities that don't matter. You're most likely going in and dealing with vulnerabilities in which nobody's trying to compromise or break in. So here's my problem. Yeah, a low-hanging fruit approach might only take 100 hours, and a real detailed risk assessment might take 1,000 hours, but that 100 hours isn't going in and improving your security at all. And therefore, that's 100 hours that you could have been spent at least making progress on the bigger risk assessment. So you always have to go in and look at what are the goals you're trying to achieve. But in my experience, just going after the low-hanging fruit can be a very, very dangerous thing to do because you're giving the impression that you're focusing on security when in many cases you're not. Because if you're just fixing the easy stuff and the easy stuff doesn't have any threats and the easy stuff is not what the adversary is coming after, then you're not really making a lot of forward progress. However, it determines what you call low-hanging fruit. If you call low-hanging fruit going in and reducing the attack surface, like going in and uninstalling services, applying patches, and getting rid of systems that are not visible, then that is absolutely on target because now what you're doing is you're reducing the attack surface. So I guess it all depends on your terminology. If you're going in and reducing the attack surface, So there's less systems, less services, and less ports for somebody to break into. That's absolutely on target. But if you're just going in and fixing this and this and this because it's easy and it's not reducing the attack surface and it's not focused on real threats, that I would be real careful of. So it always goes back to the goal. What is the goal of you're trying to achieve, and is that goal worth those 100 hours that you put into that effort? And in most cases, if it's just fixing random items, it's not. If you're reducing the attack surface, then it absolutely is. Yep. And I'm glad you said that, because what you said is not what I was thinking of with low-hanging fruit. So when our clients go in and typically say they're going to fix the low-hanging fruit vulnerabilities, it's done with no analysis. So literally, they just go in and say, okay, what are the simplest, easiest things we can do? And let's just start fixing it with no analysis and no data to drive it. What you just said was you're really doing a multi-phased assessment. So what you were calling your low-hanging fruit is what I call a level one assessment. You went in and you didn't identify every asset, but you identified the categories. And you went in and looked at likelihood, impact, and cost to determine which ones made the most sense. And then if you had something that was very expensive but low likelihood, you wouldn't do it. And if you had something high likelihood that's relatively cheap, you would do it. I call that cost-benefit analysis, which is the correct way of doing it. And then you keep circling back through that process. So I'm glad you gave clarification, because what you're doing is actually what we're going to recommend here, is that you go in and take a cyclic approach. Go through and look at fairly quickly what are the high risk, high impact that are the cost effective ways of fixing it. Fix those and then sort of keep repeating the process over and over and over again. That's what we typically call a qualitative process, where you're doing high-level analysis, coming up with the general categories, doing cost-benefit analysis, and seeing which ones give you the best return on investment for that investment and focusing on those. That is absolutely risk-driven thinking, which is not what typically we think of when we say low-hanging fruit. Low-hanging fruit is typically no analysis backing it. So what you're doing is actually right on the money and going to be aligned with exactly what we're covering. So thank you for giving the clarification. The question is, if I'm hired by a company to go in and measure the risk posture of their organization, would I go in and measure against some checklist, compliance, or regulations, or would I go in and measure up against risk? Yes. You got to do both. Because one without the other is misleading. If I go in and all I do is a compliance checklist, you can be compliant and not be secure. If I go in and just do a risk assessment, you could be secure and not compliant. So the two are complementary. They're not mutually exclusive. So what I would need to do is I would need to go in and typically I would assess the risk, and then I would look at the compliance or regulations that they have to adhere to. And that would set the boundaries of what is or is not currently acceptable risk. Then I would look at where the organization is currently meeting the regulations at an acceptable level of risk, and I would cross those items off. Then I would go in and I would have two lists. One, which are items that are not compliant with the regulations, and items that are not acceptable risk based on the business they're in. And then I would look at ways to go in and be able to try to cross items off both lists at the same time. Because if I can go in and implement a mitigating measure that will meet the spirit of the regulation and also reduce the risk to an acceptable level, that's ideally what I want to do. So I'm going to be aligning up the regulations that are not compliant and the vulnerabilities that are not acceptable, the risks, and I'm going to try to align which ones up and then look at mitigation measures that will reduce or get all of those to that acceptable level. So the two have to drive and work together, because one without the other is not going to set you up for a cost-effective security solution. So in order to go in and look at the likelihood of something occurring, there's essentially three sources we use in control systems. One is historical data for your company. So you go back and you look at your organization for the last 5 or 10 years, and you say, okay, how many times has this occurred, and what is the frequency in which that's occurring? So that's the data point one. The second data point is you go and look across your industry. So if you're a utility, you're going to look at other utilities. You're oil and gas, you look at other oil and gas, and you look at across your industry, what are the likelihood of this occurring in other areas and other systems? Now, those two items, by the way, are the same in IT that they are in control systems. So both areas we do that. However, control systems add in a third model that we typically don't use in the IT world, which is statistical modeling. And that's where you have safety regulations and other factors where you can go in and perform statistical modeling on what is the likelihood of certain events occurring in certain areas. The simplest way to look at that is if you have something that can cause loss of life, yet you have no redundancy or failover capability, then statistically speaking, because equipment fails, that is going to be high likelihood. But then if I have alternative measures or redundancy, that's going to lower that likelihood. So there are statistical modeling techniques that we utilize in certain control system environments that are highly driven based on safety to also say, based on the controls that are in place, what is the likelihood of this occurring? So we're going to use historical data. We're going to use information across the industry, and then we're going to use statistical modeling, and all three of those are going to drive together to determine the likelihood of what could occur. Now, the most important thing to remember here, risk requires uncertainty. Risk is what is the probability of something occurring in the future? We don't know. None of us know the future. None of us know what the future holds, which means don't aim for perfection because you can't. Nobody can 100% accurately predict the future, and that's what we're trying to do with risk. So we're trying to come up with a probability of what could happen, not 100% guaranteed. That's the problem I have with security folks, is they want to get exact, perfect numbers, and it's not going to happen. And guess what? You're not going to get it right. The goal in security is if you do all the modeling that we're talking about, you will get it right more than you get it wrong, but you are going to get it wrong. Because you don't know what the future holds, you're not always going to get 100%. So the goal is to try to get it within the ranges as opposed to getting it perfect, because there will always be uncertainty in doing these calculations. So at this point, let's go ahead and take our morning break. We'll come back in 15 minutes and we'll keep our journey going on how we model and control risk in our ICS environments. So before break, we're talking about risk and the importance of calculating and understanding risk. I want to take it just a little further, where we started off by saying security is all about risk. And then we took it a little deeper saying security is all about managing, controlling, and mitigating risk to your critical assets. I'd like to take it one step deeper, where security is all about managing and controlling and mitigating the risk of disclosure, alteration, or destruction of your critical information. So when we're talking about risk in our environment, there's really three categories. We're looking at our critical information being disclosed to people who should not have access to it, is altered so it's no longer accurate or correct, or it's not available to those who need it to make proper decisions. Now remember, that also aligns with the three goals of security of confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So confidentiality is dealing with prevent, detect, deter the unauthorized disclosure of information. Integrity is dealing with the alteration, and availability is dealing with the destruction. Here's the important alignment. Which one is highest priority to your environment? Which one is second and which one is third? Because while all three are important, you can't do three things at once. You have to go in and prioritize your resources. Here's a great exercise that shows if your security program is aligned with the goals of your organization. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to take your organization and put these three in order of priority. Which one is first? Which one is second? Which one is third? Typically in control system environments, one of these, integrity or availability, is going to be one and two. And traditionally, confidentiality is three. Now you might shift it around a little bit, but for your organization, which one is in the number one spot, which one is in the number two spot, and which one is in the number three spot? Once you have that list, put it aside. Then take that spreadsheet that you did yesterday of all of the security that you've purchased over the last 5 years and put it in a spreadsheet with three columns: confidentiality, integrity, availability. For every device, if it deals with confidentiality, put a one in that column. If it deals with integrity, put a one. And if it deals with availability, put a one. Then after you fill out the spreadsheet, tally up each column and see which column has the largest number. Put them in order of the numbers and see if that list aligns with your prioritized list. If it doesn't, you're misaligned. I was brought in June of this year to a large utility company because their executives was beyond frustrated. They've spent over $23 million on security, and there was no measurable reduction in incidents and increase in security. So they're like, Eric, we're just throwing money at this problem and it's not getting any better. We're not any better off than we were 3 years ago before we spent all this money. What in the world are we doing wrong? Now, there were many things, but the first thing we did with them was that exercise. And when we did the exercise with them, they went in and determined that 50% of their security should be availability, 40% should be integrity, and 10% should be focused on confidentiality. That's what they felt they needed, and we verified it with the missions of the organization. When I looked at what they spent their $23 million on, 93% of it was confidentiality, 7% of it was integrity, and 0% was on availability. And when I showed that to the execs, it became crystal clear of why it wasn't working. They weren't focused on the problem that they were trying to solve. They were misaligned their security program. So we went in and realigned their entire security program to align with their prioritization. So this is one of those really simple but very eye-opening exercises that I want you to work on when you go back to your business next week, because it's really going to show you, are you focusing in on the things that really matter and doing what you should? Then once we're aligning our risk program and make sure we're focusing in on what we should, we then want to ultimately control and manage access to our critical resources. So the way we do that is with what we call AAA, authentication, authorization, and accountability. So we want to go in and be able to authenticate that people are who they say they are. We then want to go in and only give them the least amount of access they need to do their job. And then we want to hold them accountable for their actions. So once again, in your environment, how well are you doing at authentication? How well are you able to prove that someone is who they say they are? Now, in order to have accountability, what's required for authentication? One-to-one relationship between a person and an account. Translation, no shared accounts. We do not ever want to share an account, because the problem is if three people are all logging in under the same credentials and that account does something bad, you don't know who did it. You don't know which person to go after and which person to go in and take action against. And do you realize if you have three people sharing one account, and they steal significant information and money from the organization, and you can't figure out which of the three, you can't put all three in jail. You can't sue all three, and you can't fire all three. If you don't have accountability, you don't have a case. So it's critical that with our authentication, we have a one-to-one relationship, and then we can authenticate on four basic things. Something you know, a password. Something you have, a token or an access card, something you are, biometrics, and some place you are, a physical location. Now, this is one where for real critical assets, we would prefer to have multi-factor authentication based on something other than passwords. What's the problem with passwords? Passwords can be guessable. Passwords can be written down. And passwords can easily be guessed by an adversary. So we often would like to have two-factor, an access card with a biometrics or an access card with a PIN. Problem, a lot of the older equipment and control systems doesn't fully support two-factor, doesn't support biometrics or other measures. Here's a trick. Your devices might not be able to support it, but you can put a proxy in front that can support it. So what we did with one client that was having a huge issue with passwords, compromise written down, is we went in for the critical systems, we re-engineered, so there was a new authentication proxy in front of those systems, and that authentication proxy supported two-factor. So you actually authenticated to the proxy, and then the proxy was the gateway to those devices that you entered your password in. So the only way you can get to the devices was through the proxy, and the proxy required a robust two-factor. That's what we call a mitigating control. We couldn't change the actual devices, but we could wrap security around it at a network or application level. And then authorization is focusing in on least privilege, giving someone the least amount of access they need to do their job. Actually, when we talk about authorization, we actually go and break it down a little further. So we start with least privilege, where we give somebody the least amount of access they need to do their job. What if the least access they need to do their job still represents an undue risk to the enterprise? What if the minimal access that's needed by a engineer can still cause way too much damage? We're then going to do separation of duties. We're then going to break it up over two or more parties, so two different people need to work together to accomplish that task. Now, what's the problem with separation of duties? If you have two people that are working together day in and day out to accomplish a task, they most likely are going to become friends. They're going to get to know each other. They're going to start hanging out, which means the whole reason of doing separation of duties is to have checks and balances. And the closer these two people come as friends, the greater the chance they will work together to do collusion within the environment. So in order to minimize collusion, we would then have to do rotation of duties where you have different people work with different folks at set intervals. That's why if you ever look at shift work in high risk utility companies, what do they always do? They always rotate the staff and the supervisors. So you're not going to have the same supervisor with the same staff all the time. You're going to rotate those through for checks and balances. And if you want an interesting exercise of that, if you've ever gone to Las Vegas, look at the gambling floors. If you go in and look at any shift, there's a supervisor, and then there are the people working the table. Go the next day. it'll be the supervisor with different folks. They rotate the supervisors around the casino, so any supervisor is never working with the same staff over and over and over again. Because if one supervisor is working with five people for 3 years, there's a great chance they can work together. If you rotate it, it makes it much harder. So these strategies are not just hypotheticals. We actually use them in a regular basis in real life because they do work. So when we're talking about authorization, the first thing we want to look at is what is the minimal access they need to do their job. We then want to say if that risk is too great to the environment, we want to break it up over two or more parties. And then to minimize the risk of collusion, we want to go in and do rotation of duties in that environment. So once again, a lot of what we're going through today on the governance is really checklists and validations for you to go back. What we're really doing today is building up audit checklists. So when I went in and told you, determine the priority, the percent, look at it, you're auditing and validating to see if you're doing what you say you're doing. So what I want you to do now is go in to your organization next week and figure out how are you authenticating? Is the authentication correct based on the risk? And what percent of shared accounts do you have? And then go in and look at, are you doing least privilege? Do you have separation of duties and do you have rotation of duties? So we're systematically going through to identify and see what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong to improve and increase our security. This is another challenging area, but once again, I'll just throw it out. In today's day and age, in the year 2013, you will not be able to have effective security if you don't have data classification. It's really that simple. But Eric, we haven't been doing data classification for 15 years and we've been fine. Yes, here's why. 15 years ago, attacks weren't data focused. 15 years ago, we didn't have data flows to unsensitive network. 15 years ago, we didn't have the large amount of data that we have today. So 15 years ago, if you didn't have data classification, you could fake it until you made it. Today, where everything is data focused, information is stored in digital form, and attackers are going after your data, you will not be able to have proper security if you do not know and understand the sensitivity of your data stores. Here's the simple argument. Is there data in a control system environment that needs to flow out of the environment, flow to untrusted networks, and potentially flow to the internet in order for the business to operate? Yes, there is certain information that does have to flow out of the supervisory network and potentially go to untrusted environments. That is needed for the business. Second question, is there information and data that can never leave trusted networks, can never flow to untrusted networks, and if they do, could cause significant harm and impact to the business? Absolutely. So question, if there's some information that needs to flow out of the organization and some information that can never flow out of the organization, and you don't have data classification to recognize the difference, how are you going to protect it? How are you going to secure it? How are you going to implement effective security? If you don't understand which data can leave and which data can't, how are you going to be able to allow some to leave and some not? You're not going to be able to. So today, you need to have data classification. Now, every organization in here is different and unique. So I know this next statement is going to be a little risky, but I still want to throw it out there. One of the questions I often get as we start wrapping up this class, so I'll throw it out there on our last day, is Eric, across all the different clients you work on with control systems, what are the two biggest gaps? So if you had to go in and say, what are the two biggest problems and two biggest gaps that you see consistently across this industry, what would they be? The two biggest gaps from a security perspective are data classification and lack of log correlation and analysis. Not having a SIM-SEM or centralized logging and not having data classification. Those are the two biggest problems. Why? Because if you don't have data classification, you don't know where the information should or should not go. And if you don't have detailed log correlation, you don't know when there's a problem. So the two are needed together. One is going to show you what information can or cannot flow, and the other one's going to identify and show where there's a problem or an issue in your organization. Now, careful. Eric did not say you must do data classification. Eric did not say you must install a SIEM. What did Eric say? Everything you do in security is driven by risk. So what Eric said is, if you don't have data classification today and you don't have a SIEM solution today, look at your security roadmap and ask yourself, is every item on your 2014 roadmap a higher priority than data classification and log correlation? If it is, don't do it. So if you can go in and you can show me your 2014 roadmap and you can show me that everything on there is a higher priority than data classification and a higher priority than SIEM, don't do it. But I don't think you will. You probably will not get very far down that list before you realize that these are high priority items. Now, when we talk about data classification, anybody who tells you that data classification is simple and easy is lying. It is a hard project. I had one client for the last 4 years. I kept telling them, you need data classification. You need data classification. You need that. And they kept saying, it's too hard. 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 3 months ago, they had a breach where they lost $45 million worth of information. And I looked at them and said, okay, data classification, how long would it have taken you? They said, it's a 2.5 year project. I said, if you would have stopped whining 4 years ago, you would have had it and this could have been minimized. So start the project. Yes, it might take a few years. Start the project. Now, I'm going to do one better. I'm not just going to say start the project. I'm going to give you three tricks. Yes, data classification takes time, but there's three big mistakes we see our clients make in this space, and I'll show you how to avoid them. The first one, when you look at a control system environment, there's a lot of levels. You got a lot of zones, a lot of levels, a lot of type of data, a lot of information. So when you start building out this data classification, what's the temptation? The temptation is to come up with this very complex multi-tiered scheme. So we had one of our utility clients that was struggling with their data classification project, and they brought us in to help them out. And when we get brought in, they were going and rolling out a 19-level data classification scheme. They had 19 levels of different data classification within their environment. And I sat in a meeting. I'm not kidding you. I sat in a meeting for 35 painful minutes. They were arguing over the level of one piece of data. Well, it should be a 14. Well, it should be a 13. Well, it should be a 10. Well, it should be an 11. Well, it should be a 15. And after 35 minutes, I was looking for a pen or any sharp object because I figured getting rushed to the hospital was less painful than sitting in this meeting any longer. Right? I was going to put myself out of the misery here. And finally, after 35 minutes, I just raised my hand and go, time out. I said, do you realize how much data you have in this environment? I said, I was texting the IT person during this meeting, and he said that you have over 800,000 primary files and data stores. If we spend 35 minutes on every single item to classify it, you will have a data classification scheme in 3,022 years. If that's what you want, then let's keep going at this pace. But this is not going to scale. The problem, I really don't need 19 levels of granularity. Data classification is not for me to go every intricate detail on every piece of information. The goal of data classification at a most fundamental level is really what to answer what? What information can leave and what information can't. So at the most fundamental level, I have two levels, public private, classified, unclassified, whatever you want to call it. But really, at the most fundamental level, that's the question I need to answer. I need to be able to go into any one of these zones and say, can the information leave or must the information stay? So the solution is, when you roll out a data classification project, start with two levels. Public, private, classified, unclassified, open, closed, whatever works for you. Start with two levels only. Then, once you get those two levels, if you then want to take classified and further subdivide it into two or three categories, you can, but you really shouldn't be having more than three or four levels. Here's the ultimate test. You only have different levels if there's different security controls that you put around those levels. If you're going to have the same security controls, then it's one level. So we took our client that had 19 levels, and literally we broke it down into three levels. Why? Because when we looked at their levels, levels 1 through 7 all had the same controls and all had the same mitigating measures. That's one level. Then 8 through 15 was another, and then 16 through 19. So when I looked at their mitigating measures and I saw similarities, we just collapsed it down. So we took their 19 levels and made it a three-level policy. And just to show you that works, they previously spent 11 months and got about 1% of the project done. After we collapsed down to three levels, they spent 11 months and had 60% of the project done. It's got to be something that people can agree on and that you can move quickly. If you get too granular, people are going to argue over things that aren't important. Is it public or is it private, and then further subdivide? If you keep it at that level, it's going to be pretty easy to do. That same meeting where they were arguing over 11, 12, 13, 14 for 35 minutes and got no resolution, when we broke it down to three levels, 1, 2, and 3, they all agreed it was a 2. We had the agreement within 30 seconds when we made it scalable. That's your test. Your test of whether your classification is too complex is, take 5 people and ask them what the classification level is. And if they can't get agreement within 60 seconds, your scheme is too hard. Your scheme is too complex. Because think of the size of your organization. This has to be something that can scale very quickly. So the first trick, start with two levels, public and private. If you need to further break down private into 2 or 3 areas, you can. But the simpler, the better, because the more scalable it's going to be. Okay, the first one is go in and start with two levels, public or private, on the system. And then the subcategory of that is further subdivide private. But remember, don't make it crazy. Don't make it too crazy. Start with only 2 or 3. Second mistake. When organizations roll out data classification, what do? They go in and they start classifying up information. So they'll start examining the data going, yep, this needs to be classified. Yep, this needs to be classified. Yep, this needs to be classified. What's the problem with that? If it's going to take 2 years to do this, and there's really, really sensitive information, and it takes me 9 months to get to it, that information will be unclassified for 9 months, which is greatly exposed and not good for the organization. Solution, when you roll out your data classification project, you make all data classified by default. Then you go through and only declassify data that's needed for the business and doesn't represent an undue risk to the organization. So the second trick is, by default, you make your information classified, and then you only declassify based on business need. Third, when you roll out data classification, what's the obvious place to start? Existing data. So you go in and you start classifying your existing data. What's the problem? The solution is not bounded. So we had a client that had 32 terabytes of information, and they spent 6 months classifying 7 terabytes. Conventional math We'll say if you started with 32, you classified 7, you're now down to 25 terabytes. What's the problem? During that 6-month interval, they created 10 new terabytes of information. So now they started with 32 terabytes, they worked for 6 months, and now they have 35 terabytes. The problem is growing in the wrong direction. So the third solution is when you roll out data classification, start with the new data first. So go in and say starting January 1st, all new information will be classified. Now by starting with the new information, what are you doing? You're bounding the problem. So now if starting January 1, all new information is going to be classified, your existing data will stay the same. Now if you go in and you spend 6 months classifying 7 terabytes, it will actually get smaller and smaller over time. So those are the three tricks. Start with 2 levels, make the data classified by default, and start with your new data first, and then focus on the existing data, and that will give you a much more scalable solution for success. So we go back and we're talking about our risk. Risk equals threat times vulnerability. And we know that vulnerabilities are weaknesses in the system that allow harm to be caused. Vulnerabilities are the gateways that allow a threat to manifest itself. Vulnerabilities are the way that you lower risk. However, as we've been talking about, you want to go in and you want to fix the vulnerabilities in which there's a real threat. Now, how do most organizations do their vulnerability analysis? They do what we call a bottom-up approach, which essentially is patch, 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 patch. Most companies, if you look at how they reduce and deal with vulnerabilities, it literally is patch, 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 patch. Problem with that approach is patches are disruptive, patches are reactive, and patches are typically a gap between when the exploit is written to when the patch comes out. So you're playing catch up and potentially in a position of weakness. What I like to do with controlling and managing vulnerabilities in our environment is go in and take a top down approach. So the way that works is you want to go in and you want to create a network visibility tree for your organization. So you want to go in and take all your IP addresses, and you should go in and say what IP addresses are visible, what ports are open, and what services are running for each of those ports. Then start at the top and prune the tree. Go in and reduce the attack surface. So now what we're going to do is we're going to go in and say, okay, do every one of these IPs need to be visible? If not, then let's get the system off the network. Let's prune the tree. Now guess what? By going in and having less systems visible, we've made it harder for that adversary to break in. Then we're going to go in and say, okay, why is our SSL server running DNS? We don't need it. Prune the tree. Get that off. Why are we running Apache 1.3 when 3.5 is the latest? Let's go in and update. Why is SendMail running a relay service when we don't need the relay service? Let's go in and prune the tree. So now we're going in, removing components and services that are not needed, and then we go in and patch, patch, patch. Now, the big difference in vulnerabilities and control systems is you have to prune the tree before it goes into production. Most corporate environments, you throw it into production, and then you analyze and prune. In ICS, because once it goes through acceptance testing and goes on a production network, you're not changing a whole lot. So this actually has to be done proactively in the environment. Now watch what's going on here. Why is defending so much harder than attacking? Attacking is always easier than defending. Simple. If you're attacking on the offense, how many vulnerabilities How many weaknesses do you need to find in order to get in? Just one. If you're defending, how many vulnerabilities do you need to find in order to protect your environment? All of them. Well, here's the issue. If I have a very complex environment with a lot of systems, a lot of ports, and a lot of services, how easy is it going to be for the adversary to find one vulnerability? Pretty simple. How hard is it going to be for us to find all vulnerabilities? Real difficult. That's why many companies are losing on security. But wait, there's hope. What if I go in and I make my environment more simple? What if I go in and reduce the attack surface? What if I have strict configuration management? What if I know every asset? And what if I control change within my organization? Now, if my environment is predictable, scalable, and something I understand, and simpler, what have I just done? I've made it hard for the adversary and easy for us. That's how we win at security. We have to change the rules. Right now, our environment, especially in control systems, is structured to make it easy for the adversary and hard for us because we have too much on our network that's not needed. If we restructure and simplify the environment, we are now making it harder for the adversary and easier for us. We need to change the rules in favor of the defense as opposed to creating an environment that can is continuously easier for the offense. Then when we talk about defense in depth was originally built out of necessity. The idea of defense in depth is there is no single device that you can deploy that will make your organization secure. There is no single mechanism that if you put on your network will protect your entire environment. Therefore, defense in depth was built out of necessity that says we need to go in and have multiple measures of protection in place in order to get a comprehensive approach to security. But today, it goes beyond necessity. Let me ask you a question. What if there was a magical security solution? What if there was this solution that made us 100% secure and solved all security problems? Would you want to use it on your network? No, and here's why. If there's one security device that provides all your protection, how many devices have to fail for an adversary to get in? One. How many items have to be bypassed or compromise to get in? 1-1-1. So we don't want that. What we want is have multiple items. So if any one item fails, the other items will take over. The ultimate test of defense in depth is you should take your accurate network diagram that has all your security devices and you should be able to remove any one security device and still have effective security. That's defense in depth, where you can go in and have any one item fail and still be okay. If you want to verify how good your defense in depth is, you go into your diagram and give an effectiveness of every security. Take every single security device on your network and determine what the effectiveness level of that device is. How many packets is your firewall dropping? How many true positives is your IDS catching? How many attacks is your NIPS blocking? That's what you want to look at, and you should have your effectiveness levels pretty equally spread across all those devices. What we don't want to see is one device is doing 90% of the security, and the other devices together are doing 10%. Because if that one device fails, you lose 90%. What you really want with defense in depth is your effectiveness levels to be fairly flat and distributed. So all your devices are in the 10 to 15% range. So this way, if any one item fails, the impact to your environment is going to be minimal. Then defense in depth is not just about prevention. Remember our analysis yesterday. We want to do inbound prevention and outbound detection. We want to be able to go in and prevent bad things from coming in, recognizing that we can't prevent all attacks, and then we want to do outbound detection to detect compromises in a quick, efficient manner. So defense in depth, you should really be going in and looking at three things. First, is your effectiveness of each device equally diversified across your security devices? Second, do you have a good balance of preventive and detective solutions? And third, do you have a good balance of inbound and outbound analysis? For defense in depth to be more than a buzzword and be an effective solution, it's got to have equal effectiveness, it's got to have prevention and detection, and it's got to have inbound and outbound filtering in our environment. So when we look at defense in depth in control systems, there's sort of three general strategies we look at. Uniform protection, protected enclaves, and information-centric. Now remember, the idea of defense in depth is that we're doing multiple things in our environment. So the trick with this slide is don't pick one, do all. Effective organizations do all three of these to protect and control and lock down their environment. Where we typically start with security, defense in depth, and control systems is with uniform protection. Uniform protection is where all systems get a equal set baseline level of security. So with uniform protection, you're going to go in and all servers are going to build off of a standard hardening guide. You're going to have centralized patch management. You're going to have endpoint security. You're going to have all systems behind a firewall and an IDS within their environment. Uniform protection is where all assets are protected in an equal, consistent manner. Now, the value add of uniform protection is it's very scalable because now literally any new asset, every asset, every system gets the same level of protection. So now you're baselining the security in your environment.